Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 229 of the Chills at Will podcast. It's a pleasure today to be joined by Will Summer. Will covers right-wing media, political radicalization, and right-wing conspiracy theories in the United States. His 2023 book is Trust the Plan, The Rise of QAnon and the Conspiracy That Reshaped America. He is also featured as an expert on QAnon in HBO's Q Into the Storm. He has previously written for the Daily Beast and now works as a media reporter for the Washington Post. That was a short summary. I know there's a lot more to fill in. I know you've accomplished a lot in that short life, but good morning / afternoon. How are you?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you. We'll get to the book, of course, which will be the main thrust of our conversation. Again, pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for even giving us the time. As we were saying before recording, a lot of what we're going to talk about is just stranger than fiction, right? Couldn't even make this stuff up. The greatest Hollywood screenwriter, right? Man, the greatest Hollywood screenwriter, including whoever wrote the movie called Squall.
Right? Yes, White Squall, yes.
White Squall, excuse me. No, that's where the where we go one, where we go all comes from.
Yes, that's so the QAnon's the sort of the central slogan of QAnon is where we go one, we go all, which sort of has a weird syntax to it. Huh. And when people looked up where this came from, it was a movie, I think in 1996, I believe was a Tony or Ridley Scott movie, and it's okay. It's a thriller. It's sort of an action thriller about like troubled boys who are then sort of made into men on a schooner that runs into a storm. And so, I mean, very like forgotten movie, but for whatever reason, whoever's behind QAnon really latched onto it.
Huh. I was wondering if it'd be like, it was like 1984 from, you know, Orwell became like a bestseller once Trump and all the dystopian things came into play. I wonder if that movie has gotten a resurgence at all.
Yeah. I think it has. I mean, these guys, you know, in some ways, though, the QAnon people sort of they decided retroactively that this was too silly of an origin for their slogan. And so they decided, well, actually, that was written on the bell on JFK's private yacht, which is just completely made up. Oh, okay. And so all of these they're very into movies in general. I mean, a lot of sort of long forgotten or semi forgotten movies that they then really latch onto.
Wow. Google, I believe, says your age, and I see you as so young, mid-30s, but you've accomplished so much. So I wonder about, just about your reading and writing life growing up. Were you the kid that was always in the library? You know, were you reading Bernstein and Woodward at age five? Like, how was what was your reading and writing life like as a kid?
Yeah, that's such a fun question. I mean, growing up, I was always like very bookish and very into writing. I was initially very into sort of like elementary school, into just writing fiction and just sort of sitting at a computer and just sort of unspooling these stories. And then I decided that, you know, writing fiction wasn't responsible enough and I needed to go where the big money was, which was journalism. and at the time, you know, this seemed like a relatively reasonable career. I joined my high school paper and, you know, it's just nothing has sort of excited and delighted me like journalism does and pursuing it every day. And so that was sort of how I made my transformation and then joined my college paper and just sort of it went from there. And I mean, it really is, it's a very tough industry for a lot of folks, but I mean, I really wake up every day just sort of stunned that I'm allowed to do this and mm-hmm. make a living from it.
Wow. Yeah. The school paper to professional journalism pipeline, right?
Yeah, I mean, I met my wife there. I met really all my close friends. I mean, it's I initially joined because they had parties, And, you know, and it was, you know, I was not joining the frats or anything else. And so and then I said, oh, maybe I'll stick around for a little bit. But yeah, I mean, in terms of writing, I think I've just always really enjoyed it. And, you know, I mean, book wise, I think, yeah, I mean, you know, you don't you sort of take for granted, you know, as I'm sure you were no doubt reading a lot of books as a kid. And then just the way that that also, you know, you sort of develop sort of an innate sense of writing that I think is very hard to sort of replicate if you weren't just as a kid passing so much time just reading.
Sure. Well, I wonder if there, I mean, there might be a friend of yours listening to saying, wait a minute, you said all of your friends you met in journalism, every single one. Uh-oh. Okay.
Well, I was the... Oh no, you know, I was the advisor for my college just a few years ago. I went back to school at Georgetown and I was the advisor to the students then. And they said, you know, did this paper play a big role in your life? And I thought, like, God, I'm like the biggest loser. I was like, you know, my roommates, like all the best men at my wedding, you know, my wife, all this stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's sort of like with anything in college where you kind of just join a club and it sort of becomes your life. I think a guy who was on the paper and later went on to be a journalist said that, you know, he spent much of his career at the paper, much to the detriment of his college career. And so, you know, it's very similar. But anyways, so that's where I got where I am. Yeah.
We'd rather that you meet a lot of friends and get in the sort of club with journalists rather than like the ranch in Arizona, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
A lot better alternatives. A lot better alternative. A lot more positive and healthy.
Yes.
So I wonder, as you got into high school and to college, I wonder who were some of the writers, what were some of the texts that you were that really inspired you and also challenged you and made you think, kind of that double idea of, my gosh, this writer, she's so good, I can never be like this, but also I want to write like her, you know?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, what a fun topic. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, just to focus on nonfiction, I mean, I think Ryszard Kapuściński was a big influence for me, who is a, I believe, Polish writer in the Cold War who did a lot of sort of travel and war journalism. Now, some of it later turned out to be a bit made up, but I didn't realize that at the time. It was like, wow. You know, I went to the Georgetown School of Foreign Service with the idea of being like a foreign correspondent, which turned out to be not quite such an easy job to get. That's sort of how I initially, I mean, just the idea of... I grew up in Houston, which was not like a very like media plugged in place. So it's not like people were saying, all right, you know, here's new journalism. And then we're going to track that through. Okay. Here's your Janet Malcolm, you know, and your Tracy Kidder and what have you. And so I sort of discovered a lot of it, kind of bumbled into it on my own. There was that, you know, I love the writing of Charles Bowden, who wrote a lot about the border and about drug dealing. This fabulous book that I think is often under discussed, which is called Down by the River, which is about a DEA agent whose brother is murdered. And then there's a question of like, what role did the cartel play in it? Those are like just a couple big names. I mean, I think, you know, so many people, like, you know, I mentioned Janet Malcolm, also, you know, I mean, the David Gray and Patrick Radden Keefe, more recent people,
sure,
as well. God, we're doing this at a good time because I've kind of been on a real jag of just reading, you know, like getting old magazine collections and stuff like that. You know, like just anything you can pick up, like an old New York Magazine compilation. I mean, I love old Texas Monthly stuff. You know, whether it's Pamela Koloff, all of these, just like, I love a good, like, twisted wrongful conviction story, particularly if, I mean, this is really getting specific, but if there's like a bogus forensic science to it, I mean, that's, and then it's, you know, oh, well, you know, they really thought he did it. Oh, it turns out bite mark stuff is completely made up. I'm kind of jumping around here, but I think just getting into old magazine journalism is just the, you know, I often feel that we're sort of, you know, I mean, not just walking in the footsteps of these giants, but that it's like, I'm in these ruins and I don't even know what like the stuff means anymore. Cause I mean, it's just how good stuff was back then. And I mean, cause they had a lot more money. It was one thing,
sure.
There's just a lot of great material out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, shoot, any advertisers listening, they can definitely micro promote to you. You said about forensic,
yes.
Very specific, very, very specific. Yeah. How about, I wonder how far back you go, and if you back to like Gay Talese.
Oh yeah, you know, honestly, that's a big hole in my knowledge, is kind of some classic new journalists, Tom Wolfe, mm-hmm. Gay Talese, so like Joan Didion and stuff like that. Sure. I mean, I would just fall down these holes. I mean, like I said, I mean, there's a lot of good material out there.
Yeah, definitely. You ever read Mark? I don't even know how to pronounce his last name. Arax, A-R-A-X?
A-R-A? No, I don't think so. Yeah.
He's just one that's on my mind. He writes a lot about like Fresno and the Central Valley in California. I just reread one he wrote about kind of like the water crisis a couple years ago, and one of like the barons of water. But yeah, there's so many writers. I'm sure you could talk for, you know,
oh yeah,
20,
I
40
mean,
minutes just listing names, right?
yeah, I mean, you got William Langeweis, who does a lot of like pilot stuff for the Atlantic. Mike Sager, who just did fabulous crime stories, did the story of The Devil and John Holmes, which became Boogie Nights. I mean, sometimes you just go to this well, and you just, I mean, when I was writing my book, I mean, there was, I mean, I spent too much time probably just being like, I'm going to just read this, you know, for inspiration and stuff like that. Yeah.
Tom Junod is another one.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Well, so you write in the book, you do an incredible job in the book about putting enough about yourself that we get to know you and your motivations, but also you're definitely not the main character. But you did write about growing up in like a conservative Texas family, you said outside of Houston. I'm thinking like Joel, can't think of his name.
Joel Osteen?
Thank you. I'm
Yes.
Thinking like Joel Osteen area, right?
Well, yeah, very much. I mean, I remember when he, because, you know, his Joel Osteen, of course, the famous televangelist now, that he his church is the old sports arena where we would go see the Rockets or the hockey team.
Oh, wow.
And so it's very like prominent in town. But yeah, I mean, you know, I came from a pretty like, you know, sort of a business Republican, like a, let's say a, like a Jeb Bush, perhaps type,
okay.
George W. Bush type Republican.
Sleepy Jeb. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it wasn't like that crazy, but I mean, it was obviously a very, you know, it's also, I mean, Houston in the mid aughts, post 9/11, I mean, it's very Republican environment.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, that's where I was coming from. And, you know, I was just consuming conservative media. I loved it. I mean, I couldn't get enough. I mean, I was just watching Fox News and listening to talk radio and all this stuff. And then, you know, became clear that that was kind of a crazy stance to have for me personally. I mean, between the Iraq War, you know, the disaster of the George W. Bush presidency and all this stuff. And then I went to college in D.C. and I was like, oh, maybe I will be moving on from that. But I still sort of perversely had this just huge appetite for conservative media. And I kept, you know, I just kept abreast of it for fun. And in particular with the rise of blogging and social media, a lot more characters emerged. And so then by 2016, you know, I'd be at these parties and people would say, "Did you ever hear of this guy named Ben Shapiro? Did you ever hear of this guy, Milo Yiannopoulos or whatever?" And I would say, yeah, like, you know, I've known that. I mean, at this point, I was working as a journalist, and I was just like, I've known about this thing for 6 months. And if people are interested in this, I should write about it. And basically, my girlfriend said, you know, maybe rather than boring me with these things every night at dinner, you could write a newsletter about it. And so I started that, and then sort of that's been my career since then.
Yeah, kind of a right-wing media hipster. You knew about it before.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is. And the deep lore that it really helps to know on these people. I mean, that the amount of like feuds they have. I mean, you know, just today, Steven Crowder, who's like a big right-wing YouTuber, he's having like a very public and messy divorce. And it's like all of these other right-wingers are taking sides. And Ben Shapiro's donating to the legal fund of the opposing side. I mean, and so like ultimately it's like, who cares? But the reality is a lot of this stuff kind of breaks out in terms of it reveals how much money goes into these operations, or there's so much like ideological stuff that breaks down in these people who are often very personally, very flawed, and very, very, very antagonistic to one another. So it actually makes it very easy to report on, because they're often more broadly secretly recording one another or leaking documents or getting arrested for crimes. I mean, so it's a very rich field to cover.
I bet. My cousin graduated Georgetown as well. You talk about that. I mean, he's, you know, I talked to him 1 week. He's in India for a wedding. You know, someone he met at Georgetown. He's in Turkey. He's in Miami. Also, having gone to Jesuit high schools and colleges, I think the joke about Georgetown is it's like, you know, as far the most liberal, like it's not really even Catholic almost, right? Very liberal.
Yeah. I mean, it's very sort of, I guess, cosmopolitan as it were in terms of sort of like the universe of Catholic schools. I mean, it's certainly not Notre Dame in that way or even Catholic University also in DC. But yeah, I mean, it was a very, I was on, there were multiple papers there and I was on sort of the alt weekly type paper, sort of the crunchier one. And that had more of sort of a larger feature writing type situation. And from there I went to, AOL had this string of like hyperlocal sites called Patch after I graduated. And I was kind of like living out in the boonies in Northern Virginia. And then I went to work for the Alt Weekly in DC, Washington City paper, which has a very kind of storied history of people like Catherine Boo and all kinds of Jake Tapper at one point working there. I mean, all these kind of great journalists. And it was a real like, you know, like let's get into the grit of the city kind of place. And I wrote about this guy who's called the Porn King, who is this kind of like notorious DC porn impresario running for mayor. I mean, I wrote about like sleazy nightclubs that were like kidnapping their patrons. I mean, as a journalist, it was absolutely a fabulous place to work.
Right. Oh my gosh. Did the Patch start out that way, or did it ever devolve into like a next door type of thing where everyone's, you know, paranoid about everyone else, or was it more kind of independent?
You know, it in a way it was sort of like a proto next door in that it was this idea that like people are, you know, correctly just super interested in what's going on in their communities. But it was the idea that we're going to have this journalist, you know, people might put in tips, stuff like that. And ultimately they realized that, you know, this was sort of before the big digital ad crash, which obviously is affecting so many publications now. And I mean, they had something like, I'd say like 40, 50 people covering just like the DC metro area, which is like a wild thing to imagine now. But I mean, it was great to do for a couple years until the money ran out. It was an interesting experience, disasters of digital media.
Yes. Well, as it is, especially in nonfiction, and especially in 2024, it's a long title with that colon there, right? Trust the Plan, The Rise of QAnon, and The Conspiracy That Unhinged America. First off, any particular places we should buy the book, any particular DC area or any other places?
Sure. I mean, I'll give some shout outs. I mean, in terms of if folks are in DC, I mean, we got Kramer Books, we got Politics and Prose, we got Solid State Books. And then, you know, I'll just give a shout out to Houston bookstores as well. Yeah. Everyone's in Houston, Brad's bookstore, fabulous in Houston. Or you can get it online. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble. It's all over the place.
Awesome. the intro is called The Storm, and it's from January 6, 2021. Therese Borderding, I guess I'm saying that right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Right? This is one of the people at the rally, or, you know, whatever you want to call it, on January 6th. The riot or the rally. And she was talking to you very credulously about mole children and tunnels and pedophiles and adrenochrome. Yeah, about how these are legitimate things, as if she were talking to you about the weather, pedophiles and tunnels and mole children and adrenochrome. This kind of is actually in the middle of the action. You kind of start around 2017, you know, kind of going back and forth. But what was that like being at that rally? And what was that like? You talk a lot about, And I will never, ever, ever in a million years understand the just MAGA in general with the merchandise, with the hats and the shirts and the thing. I don't understand that. I never will. But you know, the flags even on the cover, the Q flag and all that. But I wonder what it was like in the middle of January 6th, knowing, like you said, kind of more than most people would about the fact that this had, you know, was kindling for a fire, so to speak. But just in hearing people say things like adrenochrome is real and people are, you know, cannibals and pedophiles and all this. What is that like to be in the middle of all the action, knowing what you did and do?
Yeah, I mean, it is a very weird experience. I mean, I had been going to, at this point, just since the election had happened, I had been to two other events in DC that were sort of like similar, like clashes. They're very motivated by, very like operated by the Proud Boys. And it would be sort of like, we're gonna have like a mostly nonviolent rally during the day, and then when the evening comes, that's when we're gonna have this like crazy street fighting between Proud Boys and Antifa. And then I had a similar sense that something would happen that day, but I also, you know, it's obviously, like many people, I never assumed we would have faced like a January 6th type, what became January 6th. Right. And so, I mean, I knew I had to be there primarily because I wanted to see, you know, these, it's so educational and useful as a reporter to just get out and talk to people. And ideally in situations where they don't, you know, you get, people can really like regurgitate, particularly people consume so much Fox News and so much cable news that they can like really regurgitate what the talking points are. But when you have these kind of like fresh moments, this like, it's all going to come down to this vote. And is Mike Pence going to certify the vote or not? And then you really get people talking about what they actually believe. And in this case, Therese Borgerding, who, and the, I should say, who became sort of my like kind of prototypical QAnon believer that day. And later we didn't have time to get it in the book because of the publishing deadline, would later herself be imprisoned or charged for her role in January 6th because she helped dismantle some barricades. But I mean, talking to someone, and I've talked to many QAnon believers who just very flatly will say to you, yeah, well, I'm here because to protest the tunnels underground that hundreds of thousands of children are held prisoner as sex slaves by the Democratic Party. And also Hillary Clinton, a couple blocks from here at a pizzeria, drinks children's blood. And just very matter-of-factly, I mean, it's a truly unique experience.
Yeah, that's understatement of the century, right? My gosh, man, you were there. You write about how in some ways, you know, Trump obviously is like the perfect conspiracist in chief, you know, coming after Barack Obama's, all those, oh my God, those emails and the chains and Obama, you know, he was born in Kenya and he's a Muslim and all of this, all these racist screeds basically. But it, you know, makes a lot of sense that Trump, who is obviously not necessarily in line with the truth, it makes sense that he would be somebody who would, you know, be the president when this comes into effect, or into its greatest powers, if you will, with QAnon. You write about how in 2017, Q appeared on 4chan and with a very matter-of-fact message saying, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to be arrested by the end of the month, saying that he had this high-level Q-level security clearance, you know, ideas of red-pilling and all of that. A little bit, maybe, if you would, about the history of the beginning of that, at the beginning of Q and how he or it started on 4chan.
Yeah, sure. So 4chan, for folks who don't know, is sort of an anarchic anonymous message board. And so one day in 2017, Q pops up on sort of the pro-Trump board. And this is after a period where a lot of people had claimed to be anonymous whistleblowers saying X figure would be arrested or that big secrets were going to come out about Hollywood or the FBI. And so this is, it's important to note, I think, this is sort of at a early low point for Trump supporters during the Trump administration where, you know, the wall hadn't been built. Trump had been president for nearly a year. A lot of promises had gone unfulfilled, and the Mueller investigation was ramping up. And so this was at a point where if you're a Trump supporter, you might be eager to hear a fantasy version of the Trump administration where everything was going great. And so at this point, Q pops up and Q is taken to, this person identifies themselves as Q, and it's taken to be this high level security clearance, this code word. And Q says in sort of a very cryptic code language, says Hillary Clinton's gonna be arrested at the end of October. The National Guard's gonna be activated to stop riots in American cities. And just really twisted stuff is about to come out about our Democratic Party elites and the world elites. And so Q appears and says this. So they start to build out this sort of lore. And the fans sort of latch onto it. The people who would become to be known as sort of QAnon, because we have Q and then we have the anonymous people, so QAnon. And they sort of start building this. They say, well, I think this is what this clue means or something like that. And ultimately, you know, they can kind of believe whatever they want because few of them are, a lot of this stuff isn't falsifiable. But one that is the idea that Hillary Clinton would be arrested at the end of October.
Right.
And so when she isn't arrested, they keep going and they say, well, maybe that Hillary Clinton we see now is a clone, or maybe, you know, she's wearing a wide pants leg. Maybe it's, she's covering up that she's wearing an ankle monitor. And so the, you know, this is, we really start spinning out here. And just sort of, I've kind of taken us on a long walk here, but like to sum it up, QAnon believers believe that Donald Trump is this: the world is controlled by a cabal of Satan worshipping pedophiles in Hollywood, the Democratic Party, and banking. And Donald Trump was recruited by the military to run for president and take on this cabal. And someday this moment called the storm is going to arise, where Donald Trump will essentially institute like a fascist dictatorship in America. They like this idea, though, and arrest all his enemies and send them to Guantanamo Bay for execution. And so that is what the long-awaited storm is all about.
Wow. Wow. You also write about, thank you for that. Thank you for that summary. You write also about Pizzagate as kind of a precursor, and that was done mostly on Reddit, right?
Yeah, a lot of Reddit, a lot of Twitter.
Yeah, and just this idea, like you talked a little bit about, was it? It's called Comet Pizza or Comet?
Yeah, Comet Ping Pong. Comet and Ping so Pong. It's a pizzeria. It's in a very sort of ritzy neighborhood of DC, and so it's very popular. It's very family friendly, and so they have, like, needless to say, they have ping pong tables, and so it's kind of a place where your kid can run amok. And so it's very popular with families, and with, because it's in a ritzy area, a lot of kind of like DC power players go there.
Sure.
And so one night I was kind of checking on my usual right-wing characters, and I saw they were all posting about Comet Ping Pong. And I thought, well, I've been there. I like the food there. Maybe these guys aren't so bad. Maybe we have a little something in common. And then so I messaged them and I said, why are y'all posting about Comet Ping Pong? And one of them said, it's because they molest kids there. And I said, what? And so then suddenly I realized that this was kind of the growth of this conspiracy theory. I messaged the guy who ran Comet, and he said, yeah, we're not too worried about it. Like, you know, I think these are some idiots online. And then about a month later, someone, you know, fueled by people like Alex Jones, stumbled in there and fired off some shots because he was convinced he was going to rescue the kids. And so Comet Ping Pong and Pizzagate was sort of a proto QAnon.
Right. Oh my gosh. This is still in the intro, because the intro sets so much up, obviously. And there's a point where you're outside the Capitol again on January 6th. And this is directly from the book. You're, you know, thinking out loud or thinking to yourself, quote, what happens when a portion of the country buys into a mass delusion? And that's obviously so much of what the book's about. We have these, you know, people at the rally who consider themselves to be warriors. Just like, was it Jacob Chansley?
Yeah, like, yes, exactly. That's the Q shaman, the QAnon shaman.
The QAnon shaman. And just about this idea that, you know, we're taking America back, so many of the people said at January 6th. I mean, obviously you can't give me a number, but, like, I mean, how big was the QAnon representation of January 6th?
I think it was big. I mean, as you said, I mean, it's hard to say exactly. But I think about a year after January 6th, someone did an analysis of people who had been charged. And it was something like 60 or 70 people who had, who had it posted about QAnon, supported QAnon. And so obviously, you know, I'm also not saying, I don't have out of how many charges, but it gives you an idea of, and that's only the people who were, you know, violent enough to be charged. And so I think, and, you know, two people who died, Ashley Babbitt, who was shot by the police officer, and another woman who was Rosanna Boyland, I think, who was sort of trampled, were big time QAnon believers. Ashley Babbitt was convinced that day would be the storm. And so, you know, one point I was trying to make in the book is that I think QAnon, because it is sort of a, it's not like being a member of the Proud Boys or being a member of the Oath Keepers. And so it can be sort of a harder thing
spectrum,
for,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so it can be harder to track. But I do think that that QAnon really, and obviously you can't be charged with being a member of QAnon or something like that. But I do think that QAnon really provided a lot of the sort of the raw manpower of, you know, I think if we look at the January 6th, there's a lot of evidence that the Proud Boys, among other groups, recognize that, like, if we just kind of start things off, like if we provide a spark, then there's all this flammable material and we're going to have an explosion. And so perhaps they were associated with the first violence. But then in terms of these, like, waves of people and just this mob, I think QAnon played a huge role in that. And, you know, it fundamentally, people, it's often not understood that QAnon isn't just about, I hate Hillary Clinton or something like that, or like she should be in jail. But it's also about this sort of utopian vision, because they also think after the storm that all debts will be abolished, that that all diseases will be cured, that if you rent a home, you'll now own that home. And so there is, for, you know, it can sort of help explain why people were willing to risk prison terms or commit violence, or in Ashley Babbitt's case, die.
Well, like you said very well in the book, it's kind of a very socialist vision, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like they often have QAnon believers can sometimes have like broadly correct critiques that are just radically incorrect in practice. So they'll say, you know, like when I speak to QAnon believers, I'll say like, well, what's your evidence for, you know, this claim that you're making about this particular celebrity abusing children? And they say, well, don't you think that like powerful people abuse vulnerable people sometimes, or that the rich have too much power, or that, sure. That, you know, we should, that, you know, it's just hard to like get along as a middle-class person in this country. And I mean, that's sort of like, I will say, yeah, but I mean, that's like obviously a drastically different critique than what they're initially making. I mean, I've spoken to so many QAnon believers who they have initially a very, they have like a pretty clear-eyed view of how they became radicalized into QAnon, but they sort of think that it's good that it happened. Like they'll say, I couldn't get insurance, and I had this illness, and then I became deeply in medical debt. And then, rather than saying, you know, this country is screwed up and that we don't have a universal health care, they'll say it was the cabal that did it, or the, you know, they sort of turn this anger in another direction. And so in that way, I think QAnon has been very successful at sort of preventing people who have real issues from grappling with those issues in the real world.
Oh yeah. Chapter one is called Genesis, just like the Bible. It's there's a few cryptic comments, I guess, about things about like, you know, pictures were taken from Air Force One, supposedly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a big part of QAnon is this, because it's so obviously fake, that the people involved in it are constantly looking for proofs, or what they call Q proofs, that will prove that it's real. And so they would say, oh, well, Q posted a picture of a watch that supposedly was on Air Force One. And then there's all this analysis, oh, this picture's never appeared before or whatever. And then, you know, there's a lot of like counter analysis from critics of QAnon. I mean, it goes back and forth. But the idea is that, or like a big one is, say, if Trump says something that kind of seems like a QAnon thing, or like, so Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet. So then let's say Trump sent a tweet that had 17 words in it. Well, there you go. Or a big one is they would look at his hand motions and say, well, he kind of made a Q, you know, during this speech. Or they'll say, a big one, it was asked the question. They wanted someone in the White House press corps to ask Trump if QAnon was real at a press conference. And so they would like deluge, like Maggie Haberman, all these reporters saying, you got to ask Trump. And so, you know, in sort of a twisted way, in 2020, Trump did come out and say, well, maybe QAnon people are right about some things. And obviously that only fueled more of it.
That's what I was getting at. It was also like, I think something on Saudi Arabia, kind of a fairly innocuous thing that happened. It's like, well, supposedly more proof that something that had been predicted came true, right?
I would say there's an academic definition of conspiracy theories that I quote in the book, where it's this idea that nothing is a coincidence and everything is connected. And so whereas you and I might look at these kind of random events, like just to have ships on my mind, I mean, the recent incident with the Baltimore, bridge being knocked down, or sort of back in a few years ago, the ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal. And so they would say that this is either a distraction from what's really going on, or they would say, in the case of the Suez Canal, that like the ship was being used to traffic children, and you know, it's been run aground to draw attention to this issue by the Q team. And so they really don't, they sort of grapple with the idea of coincidences not in the way that I think the average person does.
You quote some of the surveys done that are pretty scary. One was 2021. About 15% of people polled believe that the country is run by, quote, Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. Yeah. you know, 20% or so saying that they think that this storm is coming, which, again, could be, you know, is a spectrum, what that exactly means. There were a lot lower numbers, which is good, but I don't know, and the fallibility of polls possibly, but 4 to 7%, which is obviously way, way too high, but from civics, which is one of the research companies, kind of, and that first thing I'd said, that believe that the country is run by Satan-worshipping pedophiles who run a global child sex trafficking operation. But like you point out, that's, even if it's only 4%, only, that's still millions of people, right? Well, yeah, so I don't know if you could talk a little bit about those numbers. I mean, you know, again, even 4% is way high. 15%, 20%, whatever, but just the number of people who believe in these theories.
Yeah, so like 3 to 7%. The question is something like, are you a member of QAnon? Do you believe in QAnon? And then, as you mentioned, there's sort of a more broad question about like, do you think the world is run by a satanic pedophile cabal? And let's say that's 12 to 15%. And if you, if it's specifically like, are you a member of the Republican Party? It's much higher than that. And so people might say, well, 3%, you know. But that's millions of people.
Yeah.
I mean, as that's more than there are Jewish people or Muslim people in the United States. I mean, that is a lot. And so I think, I mean, if I could kind of get on my soapbox for a second, I think that there's often an impulse, particularly among sort of like the political establishment or the journalistic establishment in DC, New York, because QAnon is sort of a hard thing to grapple with. And it's a hard thing to say, what does this mean about our country? That this many people believe in this, in what is essentially sort of a bloody fantasy vision. What does that mean? And so instead they like to say, well, that's a joke. People are trolling the polls. No one really believes in QAnon. And then you have people murdering people because of QAnon or doing January 6th. And so I think as a result, I totally understand the desire to sort of look for the most rigorous and most conservative takes on these polls. And so that's why I included in the book, you know, 3, 4, 7%. At the same time, though, I mean, it really, I think it's something that sort of calls out to be grappled with. And it's when you have, obviously, this plays out in a lot of ways. I mean, it plays out in our politics. It plays out in people's family lives, as I get into in the book. It plays out in health terms if people don't want to vaccinate their kids for anything. I mean, it is a QAnon, for whatever reason, packaged up a lot of old conspiracy theories and new stuff and put it in a particularly viral way.
Oh, man. We talked about like the White Squall movie and just kind of the random pop culture references and all these little, what's the word, like Easter eggs or crumbs. 4chan, which you go back, which is, you know, really important to trace 4chan's history because of how it affected the message boards and eventually QAnon. But so Christopher Poole.
Poole was, I think, just sort of an odd little guy. So ultimately, the guy who starts 8chan. Had very sort of complex medical issues.
Brennan, I believe, Frederick Brennan,
yeah, who had stunted his growth and all this stuff. And so, yeah, so 4chan starts, it becomes very popular. Then there's sort of like a more twisted, if you will, version of 8chan, of 4chan called 8chan, where really QAnon really proliferates.
Well, am I going to say it or are you going to say it? Christopher Poole started 4chan for anime porn.
That was certainly one of his stated goals, was that he was frustrated he couldn't. And you know what, I will say, in writing this book, I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to track that detail down. I read a book about the origins of 4chan, and it sort of had this as a tossed off line. And I had to email the author of that book to say, like, what's your source for that? Because I really want to include that. That essentially he said, you know, I was having too much trouble finding anime porn all across the internet, and so I wanted this as kind of my one stop shop.
Oh my gosh. Wow. 20 years later, you see all things happen. But so am I right then that 4chan, that, you know, there was more of a targeted one for like anime porn or that type of stuff, but this offshoot would be like kind of various and miscellaneous. And this is where a lot of the conspiracy theories flourished.
Exactly. Okay. So 4chan's had a lot of influence on the internet in terms of memes. I mean, just to pick one, and this is really dating myself, but the Iken has cheeseburger, the lol cap with the messages. And so then 4chan had a political website forum that by 2016 had become a very sort of pro-Trump outlet and also like riddled with white supremacists.
Right.
Yeah, so that is really where QAnon initially took root.
Wait a minute. Is it possible that there's a connection between the racist followers of Trump and Trump's ascendancy? Okay, so I'm finally, thank you. I'm figuring out 4chan, 8chan. I've always been so confused by them a little bit. Mm-hmm. But so you fast forward a little bit back in the book to 2018. This is when Q starts to really show up at Trump rallies with the shirts, with the flags. And like you've said a little bit already, you know, Trump really goes back and forth. He has to, on a logical level, know that it's not true. These are not true theories, but he does not want to disavow them. How much, I guess this is a bigger question about Trump in general too, but how much do you think is calculated of him purposely not wanting to ruffle feathers with QAnon, who could be some of his voters? And how much is he truly ignorant to QAnon?
I think for a while he, you know, and this is from reporting that's come out, but that he sort of saw QAnon as sort of like the Trump super fan club. And we know that in general, he's very like loath to distance himself or disavow anyone who supports him.
Sure.
And then as you know, he would say in these meetings, just, you know, those are the people who love me so much, stuff like that. And then by 2020, when this had really reached a crescendo and he started being asked about it in interviews, and he would say, for example, well, what's QAnon? And they would say, well, you know, QAnon believes that you're hunting all these pedophiles and you're going to send them to Guantanamo Bay. Mm. And he said, well, what would be wrong with that? You know, there is some truth to that. And so, of course, for QAnon believers, that was a huge moment in terms of accelerating their right. movement.
Right. I think it was maybe something Dr. Fauci said or something, but, you know, someone who's in his 80s and even Biden and Trump, you know, being older, just I think about, you know, these people that are held up as supposed like dictators, Fauci's trying to run the world. It's like, how much time is there in the day, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'm tired. I'm 44. We get tired. You know what I mean? Like, even, you know, Trump with his supposedly boundless energy, does he really have enough time to do all this hunt and watch Fox News and be president and right?
Well, that is, I mean, one aspect of it. You know, people would, you know, critics of QAnon would point at these videos of Trump hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein, you know, decades ago. And they would say, well, you know, what about this? And they would say, QAnon people would say, well, no, Trump was actually infiltrating Epstein's circle. Then. I mean, this idea, there's almost this idea that he was sort of a spy himself, right. going deep undercover.
Oh my gosh. Of course, as you also say, you know, when he was on Twitter, remember those days? Oh my gosh. when he was on Twitter, you know, I think you said he retweeted the most Q accounts of anyone, something to that effect, right?
Oh, that he retweeted a lot of QAnon accounts?
Yeah.
He would, exactly. I mean, so when Trump was still on Twitter, he would post a lot of, you know, very explicit QAnon accounts. And more recently on Truth Social, which is sort of his Twitter, he's done a lot of posting of QAnon memes, of, you know, pictures of himself photoshopped with QAnon, with Q or
He's been
17.
In the weight room, huh?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, those really buff Trump images.
In the book, of course, you're talking about, of course, social media plays a huge deal, Facebook, Twitter, with giving a sort of legitimacy to QAnon, even if you don't believe in all of the tenets you believe, like you said, oh, well, you know, are there people in power who punish those who are not yet? You know, those kind of things. So there's some sort of believable deniability as well. You write about, in one of the chapters called Q's Priests, and you really get to the idea of, you know, how many people are out there just to make money. The idea that Q is so wide ranging, so general that people can kind of fit their way in. You've talked about a little bit. I wonder, what kind of insights do you have about, I mean, people really believing that there are reptilian creatures running the world and the cabals? I mean, how much do you believe that people believe, and how much maybe do you feel sorry for someone who maybe truly does?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I think I have a lot of sympathy for the people who get in at QAnon as sort of like the average foot soldier level. I think it can really mess up your life depending on how deeply you get into it. And I think often they're driven by some very like human pathos, which are, you know, I mentioned some of them. I mean, I think this desire for belonging, sort of they want a sense of agency, like they kind of see the world as it really is. Stuff like that. I mean, I have much less sympathy for the people who are really promoting QAnon, making a lot of money. I mean, I think there's one pretty low level, you know, he has a following, but a guy who's not, I don't even think really mentioned in the book because he's not that big a deal, but a guy who nevertheless manages suddenly, he was like just kind of a nobody. And then he gets into QAnon and starts selling precious metals to his fans, you know, on the idea that there's going to be an economic collapse. And now this guy's just buying, you know, multi-million dollar houses all across the country. So there's a lot of money involved in it. And I think, you know, people always say, well, how much do these guys believe it? You know, someone like Alex Jones, for example, who had kind of like an in and out thing with QAnon. And how much do they believe it versus how much of it is for money? I mean, yeah, I think it varies really. I mean, I think some of these people are just like straight up mercenary hucksters. I think some of them really do believe it. And I think probably for the vast majority of it, I think they kind of come from backgrounds or are already prone to believing in these conspiracy theories. And then it starts taking off and they go, well, this is like more fun than having a job. You know, I mean, they certainly make a lot more money, and there are a lot of economic incentives for them to continue promoting it. And, you know, I mean, really screwing up people's lives along the way.
Yeah. Obviously larger issues, but Facebook and Twitter and social media about how much they amplify what they've done and what they haven't done to stop the spread. And, you know, around the end of 2019, early 2020, it sounds like there was, you know, major crackdowns. And so Q kind of took a little dive, and that's when COVID hit, right? So you write so much about, you know, the usual stalwarts in Q and, you know, anti-vax and all of that, but also that weird, I don't know, curve that comes around to the almost to the far left, to the crunchy, yeah, to the right, to the healthy eaters, to the people who voted for the Green Party. And you talk about a few of those people. I wonder about that changing demographic, if you will, that really kind of brought Q into the mainstream ish again with COVID.
Yeah, COVID was like a real gateway moment for a lot of people to get into QAnon. I mean, people were they had a lot more time at home to spend online. I mean, it was a undeniably chaotic time for people who suddenly, you know, understandably were looking for answers. Mm-hmm. And some of them found QAnon. And you also have to realize that right around that time was when Jeffrey Epstein died. And so there was a lot of interest in child trafficking, child sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And so from there, that drove a lot of people into it. And people who were not really necessarily in these kind of normal QAnon vectors of like being white Christian Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. And so people who would, you know, go online, and particularly this group called Save the Children, which was sort of this idea often based on sort of fallacious exaggerations of child sex trafficking as a mm-hmm. phenomenon. And you know, we also see this with Sound of Freedom, we would see this last year with that movie. And so that really, you know, I mean, who would be against rescuing children from child sex trafficking? And so people are brought in through that very pretty innocuous gateway. And then, you know, a couple TikTok lines down or Instagram posts, and they say, well, you know, who's doing all this sex trafficking? It's, you know, it's Hillary Clinton or what have you. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. Yeah, you referenced the QAnon podcast. I forget the name exactly. Is it just called? I think you referenced it in the acknowledgments or the sources, but it's a simple name. I can't remember. But one of the QAnon podcasts, and they did an episode on Jim Caviezel. Oh my god.
Oh yeah, QAnon Anonymous. Yeah, right. Yeah. And the Jim Caviezel, who's the star of Sound of Freedom, and Jesus. You know, he was a guy. I saw him at this kind of quasi QAnon convention in Tulsa, uh-huh. And he gets up and he goes, you know, this is a movie that I found out that, you know, kids are being drained for their adrenochrome and all this stuff, and I mean, it's just truly, truly bizarre. I mean, even for a guy who, obviously, his star is not what it once was, but I mean, sure. I was just thinking of it. I mean, the filmmakers of Sound of Freedom would say, "Oh, this isn't a QAnon movie," and then the star of their movie was saying, "This is a QAnon movie." So make of that what you will.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, right? Mm-hmm. It is about that. Lastly, you do have some really gripping and sad, pathetic in all senses of the word stories about, you know, some of these people who really got, you know, went down that rabbit hole, especially during COVID, more time inside. And like you said, people having legitimately sad stories about, you know, Social Security being cut off and sickness and people just being in that echo chamber that is the internet and some of these, you know, message boards. So those are really moving, especially about the ranch. Austin, tell me his last name.
Austin Steinbart.
Who's in and out of kind of mainstream circles in some ways, but kind of got booted out. Some really interesting stuff there. So just lastly about, you write about, you know, how QAnon has made its way to other countries with the Filipino Canadian woman who's called herself the Queen, and you make really good points about how the QAnon in other countries is hyper specific. It's general enough that people can fit in under its, you know, into it, but also hyper specific to Canadian needs, Canadian history, Canadian current affairs. And Germany sounds to be, you said, is the most I guess membership, if you will, of QAnon in a non-English speaking country. What is QAnon finding a foothold in Germany and Canada and Japan and other places? What does it say about the future of the movement, I guess you'd say?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's on one hand, you would think of QAnon as so specifically American. I mean, it's sort of a messianic movement about Donald Trump. I mean, it's so specifically focused on these things. I mean, these Washington pizza parlor, did Bill Maher wear red shoes? That means he's a pedophile. I mean, all these specific American characters. And yet, it has, as you said, it's found a foothold in all kinds of places. I think it's because there's this, it sort of taps into this broader kind of like conspiratorial populist movement that says there's kind of this liberal or neoliberal world order that has become very, very, you know, people are struggling against it as Donald Trump represented this figure, but also in Brazil, Bolsonaro, you know, all these other kind of right-wing figures you can fold into it. I mean, George Soros is a great villain in QAnon, both in the United States and in Hungary. I mean, QAnon has managed to sort of have this pantheon of heroes and villains that really transcends national boundaries.
Right. And so you talk about the human toll, about Kim Pacasio. Am I saying that name correctly?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For example, in Florida, and poor woman, just about how she had just been absolutely abused online and in person. It's cool to see that she has some payback that she's done, or some fighting back that she's been able to do through being a lawyer and just sticking with it. But just years of her life and being in QAnon trolls and such, you end with, you know, some possible remedies. And you're very clear. You're not going to lie and say it's going to be easy, but you talk about, obviously, you know, government apparatus can obviously do a lot of things to make people feel more comfortable and safe and, you know, middle class, like you said, and health insurance and all of those things that are broken. How can we break this hold on QAnon in maybe smaller ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is it's a very difficult thing. I mean, I think particularly in the sort of the current political environment we have, I mean, people say that, well, we just need to teach kids news literacy or something. But I mean, you know, there's just in any sort of state, it's just very difficult to imagine that, you know, a sort of school curriculum would be approved saying, you know, don't trust InfoWars, even something like that.
I know.
And so, I mean, I think it really requires sort of and maybe, you know, as time goes on and everyone gets used to the internet, maybe people, but then I don't know. You know, now we have all this AI stuff that I think, you know, stuff can be manufactured and made to look convincing so easily that I think it's a real challenge. And I think even if QAnon as sort of a name brand goes away, I think we're going to see this in the same way that Pizzagate became QAnon and so on and so forth. I think we're going to see that kind of strand stay with us for a while.
Sad, but true and honest. A really interesting book that is so cool for so many reasons. But one is that we're unfortunately in the middle of it. You know, it's not something that happened 150 years ago. So it's it's a developing story. You've said one or two things just in this conversation that have happened to these characters, and they're not characters, they're real people, you know, since. So it's really interesting that we're in the middle of it, and hopefully there's a happy ending, but yeah. probably not the cleanest ending of all sites. Thank you so much for talking with me. And it's been awesome talking to you. It's so interesting to know about the field work you did and the research you did, and just appreciate your insights.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much to Will Sommer for his time. Continue good luck to him with his important writing. You can now subscribe to the Chills of Will podcast on Apple Podcasts. Please leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter where I'm at Chills at Will P-O-1, the digit 1. You can watch other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will Podcast channel. Please subscribe to both my YouTube channel and my podcast, especially on Apple, while you're checking out this episode. I'm very excited to have one or two podcast episodes per month featured on the website of Chicago Review of Books. The audio will be posted along with a written interview culled from the audio. A big thanks to Rachel Leone and Michael Welch at Chicago Review. I'm looking forward to the partnership. Check out my recent interview with Gina Chung on the website. Sign up now for the Chills of Will podcast Patreon. It can be found at patreon.com/ Chills at Will Podcast Peter Riehl. My last name is R-I-E-H-L. Check out the page that describes the benefits of a Patreon membership, including cool swag and bonus episodes. Thanks in advance for supporting my one-man show, my DIY podcast, and my extensive reading, research, editing, and promoting to keep this independent podcast pumping out high-quality content. I've added a $1 a month tier for well-wishers and cheerleaders of the show. Thanks to new Patreon member Jessica Cuello herself a talented poet and former podcast guest. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look at an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills of Will podcast is Wind Down Instrumental, and the other song played on the episode was Hoops Instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. Please tune in for episode 230 with Chelsea T. Hicks, a Wazazi writer with an MA from UC Davis and an MFA from the Institute of American Indian Arts. Her writing has been published in the Paris Review, Poetry, McSweeney's, and elsewhere. She was selected as a 5 Under 35 honoree by Louise Erdrich for the National Book Award, and her first book, A Calm and Normal Heart, was long listed for the Pen America Robert W. Bingham Prize. The episode with Chelsea will air on April 2nd. Lastly, please go to ceasefiretoday.com, which features 10-plus actions to help bring about ceasefire in Gaza. For now, thanks again for listening. I hope that these uncertain days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Will Sommer, whose work, like Trust the Plan, The Rise of QAnon, and The Conspiracy That Reshaped America, gives you chills at will.